Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
Good morning. I'm Twyla Dang, sitting in for Angela Davis, and you're listening to NPR News. I'm glad you could join us today. The cost of keeping a roof over your head keeps going up in Minnesota. If you've tried to buy a house recently or looked for an apartment, you know what I'm talking about. Keeping housing affordable is a tangled problem that communities have tried to solve in many ways. St. Paul recently passed a rent control measure, and Minneapolis is looking to do it too. Governments provide rent subsidies for low-income tenants and down payment grants for first-time home buyers. In this expensive market, some other creative approaches are popping up that allow residents to share ownership. One of them is housing cooperatives. They became popular decades ago in cities like New York and Washington, D.C., and are slowly gaining ground in Minnesota. Land trusts are another approach. They can take single-family homes out of the speculative housing market and price them within reach of people who otherwise couldn't afford a house. Today, we're talking about why these alternative approaches are making inroads in Minnesota, and we want to hear from you, our listeners. Have you found a creative way to make your mortgage or rent? Have you moved in with other people? Downsized? Gotten financial help from family members or cut back on other expenses? Or maybe you found a program that helps you manage monthly payments. Call us at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. I'm going to introduce my first guest today, Tisha Selman. So back in 2007, Tisha bought a house in the Shingle Creek neighborhood of North Minneapolis through the City of Lakes Land Trust. She's a single mom, and she raised her two children there. Tisha, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Oh, no, thank you. So I just want to jump right in. What did it mean for you to buy your own house? Like, I understand you were the first person in your family to do this.
It meant everything, right? To be the first child of my parents. My mother's never owned a home. My parents are divorced. My mother's never owned a home. Neither of my siblings own a home. So for me to be able to purchase at 27 and provide a place of stability for me and my two children means a lot. Coming from our generations of just my grandmother never owned a home, my great grandmother didn't own a home, like those things, to be able to see that for myself and then provide that for my siblings, right? They can model that behind me, and so can my children.
That's remarkable, and I'm sure that makes you really, really proud. Can I ask you a question? How did the City of Lakes Trust help you afford your house?
They made it affordable for me to purchase what I needed and not what I could afford. And so, you know, people can buy houses if you have the credit and can get a mortgage, right? You can buy a home, but are you buying the home that you need, or are you just buying what you can afford? I know what I needed in a home, and I know what I qualified for outside of the support of the land trust, and I would have either been forced to buy a condo or townhome, which nothing's wrong with those things, but it would not have provided the space that I needed for me, my two children, for me to feel like I could stay long term, that I could have family over and host holidays, things of that nature. And so with the support of the land trust, I was able to increase what I could buy by $40,000. And then it put me in a space to find a larger space that meets the needs of me and my kids. I have a yard. I have a garage. We feel safe. We've been here, right? I've raised them in this house since 07, and they're now 23 and 18. And so I'm grateful for a place to call home that's stability. It wasn't about just getting a house and saying I own something. It was about providing home.
So do you feel like you would have been able to get, say, a three-bedroom house in a neighborhood you liked without that help?
Absolutely not. I would have had to take what I can afford in an area that I could afford it, right? The land trust provides, not only did they increase what I could purchase, but the affordability that they, the perpetual affordability they put in the home means that my house forever stays affordable in this neighborhood. So no matter what they do around here, this house stays affordable. So when you think about the average cost of a home in neighborhoods, when you put more land trust in there and provide that perpetual affordability that keeps the neighborhood from increasing drastically in value, keeping other folks from being able to get in this neighborhood.
So let me ask a couple of quick questions. Do you feel comfortable sharing with us, say, like what your average is of your monthly budget for your mortgage?
My mortgage is this year I'm at $1,042.
Okay, so at $1,042, how does having that type of a mortgage payment affect you? Like, what kind of things are you able to do because that mortgage payment is locked in where it is?
I'm able to live, right? I'm not choosing between the mortgage and groceries or mortgage and braces, right? When you think about kids and healthcare and all of those things, having my mortgage be affordable. And again, I've been in my house since 07. My mortgage has never been more than maybe $1,080, and that's only changing when the taxes go up or down, right? And so from 07 to now, I've still been at an affordable rate for my mortgage for me to, I've gone back to school and finished my degree. I've put my daughter through college. I have a son that's prepping for college. All of those things, we've been able to buy braces. I've been able to pay medical bills. I've been able to vacation. When the market crashed, because I purchased in 07 right before the housing crisis, mm-hmm. I was able to sustain that. Fortunately for me, with the pandemic, I have not been impacted like some folks with layoffs and things of that nature. But even through this, I've been able to sustain because everything is at an affordable rate.
So you're really talking about quality of life here. Let me ask you one final question. How will being in the land trust affect you when you sell the house?
The next family will be, you know, similar to me in that they can come in and get what they need at a price that they can afford because it's perpetually affordable. And that means something to me that it's almost like it's a gift I'm able to give to someone else because I was given a gift. It's not about, you know, being able to sell my house and you know, make all of this profit off of it and things like that. It's somebody else, a family just like me that needs a home that provides them stability and security can come in and purchase, and it'll be affordable for them the same way it's been for me.
Well, Tisha, that's wonderful. And really and truly, congratulations to all the success for you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So we're going to talk to some more guests. I would like to introduce some other people we're going to talk to about the housing crisis today. First, we have Tori Clark, the executive director of North Country Cooperative Foundation based in St. Paul. The organization helps tenants of mobile home parks and apartment buildings buy the properties and convert them into cooperatives. Good morning, Tori. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And we also have Jeff Washburn. He's the executive director of City of Lakes Community Land Trust, the organization that helped Tisha afford her home purchase. The group works in the city of Minneapolis. Good morning, Jeff. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Twyla. Thanks so much for discussing this topic.
Well, Jeff, I'm going to start with you. So Tisha described buying her house in 2007. We know rents and housing prices are going up much faster than income since then. Can you describe the challenges you hear from people? Like, who's able to buy a house these days and who isn't?
You know, I think it's increasingly becoming difficult, not just in Minneapolis, but across the entire state for a lot of households making, you know, $40,000 to $50,000 a year, it's just not possible to be able to find a home to purchase in the state. And those, the cost of housing, especially over the last few years, has made it really cost prohibitive for households who are out working one or two jobs, maybe even three jobs, and still can't afford to cannot afford to purchase a home today.
So, Victoria, your organization works with people who live in mobile home parks and apartment buildings. Why are we seeing housing prices rise there?
Yeah, a lot of that story is related to what I refer to as the financialization of everything these days, which is, you know, out of state investment firms, private equity firms. This is particularly felt in the mobile home park world. That we've just seen a huge rise in private speculation, out of state speculation, and that's driving up housing costs. Investors have honed in on mobile home parks in particular as a very lucrative commercial real estate asset to invest in. So a third of the manufactured housing mobile home parks in the state in the last 7 years, one third have transferred ownership in the last 7 years. 14,000 units of manufactured housing have transferred ownership. And last year alone, 81% of those units that sold of manufactured housing went to out-of-state speculative buyers.
That's a very large number. And you're essentially saying that they're looking to buy these as investments, which take them out of the hands of homeowners.
That's exactly right. Yeah, mobile home parks, if you're not familiar with them, are private. The land and the utilities, the underground utilities, are privately owned by a third party investor owner. And overwhelmingly, folks own their actual mobile home. So folks own their home, but they don't own the land underneath it. And that creates some tenuousness for the household that's owning that home, but doesn't have a lot of predictability in what's going to happen to the land underneath their home. And increasingly these days, with out-of-state speculation, that's creating, wreaking havoc on, who are some of the lowest income folks in our state.
So most people have never heard of a land trust. And we heard a bit from Tisha about how they work. Can you add to that and explain how they make a house more affordable? Jeff, I'll start with you.
Thank you. Bear with the noise in the background.
No worries.
What we do is essentially bridge the difference between what a lower or moderate household income can get a mortgage for and the cost of purchasing that home. In exchange for this investment of typically 20 to 50% of the purchase price of the home, the household agrees to sell the home to another low income household if and when they decide to sell, and agree to share in any increase in value of that property, again, if and when they choose to sell their home.
So how many houses are in a land trust in Minnesota, and how many land trust organizations are there?
Great, great question. There are 11 active community land trusts across the state. And at this point in time, there are about 1,200 community land trusts, permanently affordable homes through the community land trusts across the state. And we facilitated over 650 resales. So again, those resales are really important to the permanent or perpetual affordability that Tisha mentioned, in keeping those homes, not only creating affordable homes, but ensuring that they stay affordable for future generations of low-income households.
So Jeff, can you tell me why they've become more popular in recent years?
I think, unfortunately, it's because we're seeing such huge increases in the cost of housing, not only in the rental market, but also in affordable or just in home ownership. You know, in our market in the city of Minneapolis, it's tough to find a home for $250,000. And a lot of the buyers we're working with maybe can only get a mortgage for $100,000 to $150,000. And in the past, the public sector making investments in affordable housing didn't have to invest, $100,000 plus to bridge that difference. And what we're seeing today is, on a pretty standard basis, the need of at least $100,000 to help households who are working, who are paying taxes, contributing to the community, but they still just can't afford in this housing market.
So let's shift gears just a little bit. Tori, let's talk about the mobile home parks. I understand there are about 180,000 people in Minnesota who live in mobile home parks, and there are 800 parks across the state. How did these communities get started, and what's been happening to them recently?
Yeah, the history of the industry is really fascinating, and it has its roots in the travel trailer industry and the rise of folks, wanting to get up out of their houses and bought these travel trailers in the 1920s and 30s. And then in the 50s, it kind of reached its kind of a zenith point in, you know, after World War II, where we're housing, you know, GIs coming back from the war. These communities were popping up as a immediate strategy to house folks affordably. They popped up around college campuses, folks that were going to get their degree with their GI, with the GI Bill. And then they just kind of became permanent. they weren't designed to be permanent, but then they became permanent and the structures themselves changed right over that time. So in 1976, the HUD actually passed passed a uniform building code, and mobile homes became manufactured homes, right? So anything after that date becomes built to this national standard, right? So they become permanent dwellings, right? As opposed to the misnomer of the mobile home. So now they're manufactured homes. They're sited on permanent foundations. They're built in the same factories as modular homes. So huge change in the industry just over the last, 50, 60, 70 years here. But I think what's important to note is that they weren't initially built and designed as permanent dwellings, and, you know, essentially subdivisions. What they are is just, you know, more tightly together subdivisions. They weren't intended to be permanent, but then they've just kind of ended up that way, right? And all the infrastructure is privately owned, which comes with its own challenges. And what's happened in recent years, after the collapse, really, you can mark the change in who owns these communities after the collapse, the housing collapse of 08. And private equity firms, investors were looking for a place to, a safer place to invest their money. And this was especially true after the pandemic. That's why we're seeing such a rise after the pandemic, right? Everyone that lost their shirts investing in office buildings and other things that kind of took a hit during the pandemic see mobile home parks as a really great place. I mean, mobile home park investing promises the highest rate of return for investors of all other types of commercial real estate. That's what we're talking. That's why we're seeing the type of speculation happening in this market. And these communities have been historically what investors say is undervalued, right? They were owned by small mom and pops, family owners, you know, that owned these things, kept rents low. A lot of them lived on site, right? Real folksy stuff, which is great, right? It kept housing costs low. But investors he's zeroed in on rent, right? For them, that is, you haven't captured all of the income potential on that asset. So, and that's why we're seeing the rise of speculation.
Sorry about that. I have a quick question about that, because what happens to the rent if it's been traditionally undervalued? What happens to the rent after these parks are bought by investors? Like, what happens? How does it affect the people that live there?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing rent increases. The ones that make the headlines are over $100, you know, which, as you can imagine, in these communities is like overnight displacing huge percentages of the populations that live in these communities. But historically, the industry says like lot rent increases increase about 4 to 5% a year. You know, depending on the investor owner, you know, you're seeing, you know, upwards of 10, 20. I mean, it's not uncommon for me to get calls from folks and say, wow, I just got served a $75 lot rent increase. That's per month that folks are paying.
So let's talk a little bit about what your group does. You help mobile home park residents buy the park and convert it into a cooperative. So are they essentially becoming their own landlords? Like, how does this actually work?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's swapping one type of owner of the land for a cooperative corporation, right? So we help the residents create that cooperative corporation. The cooperation is comprised of homeowners living in the park, not unlike a homeowners association, right? Each household is entitled to one membership, one vote in that corporation. They become members in that corporation, and we help that corporation go get a loan, and they purchase it from the private owner at market price. And our model for the mobile home park space is we work with lenders who want to see an ongoing, we call it technical assistance, but it's ongoing support, right, from a third party like our organization. So that's part of the secret sauce of our model, is that not only are we helping these folks purchase their community, get the financing to stabilize it and own and operate it as a co-op, but we're providing ongoing support, right? We're with that cooperative corporation and providing ongoing training and technical assistance, financial oversight, you name it, right? Which creates that stability for residents, you know, most of whom have never dreamed of, you know, running and managing a multimillion dollar real estate asset.
Well, and I definitely have some more questions, but I want to make sure we open up the phone lines and take some calls too. So on line two, we have Omar from Irving, Texas. Good morning, Omar. Thanks for calling in. What would you like to share with us? Oh, sorry. Omar's written. I'm reading the board and we're getting this all together at the same time. So I'm going to read Omar's comment because I think it's really relevant to what's going on here. So Omar said, we sold our home in Minneapolis and moved to Texas. We moved to Texas because we could not find a reasonably priced home in the Twin Cities. So we moved out of state. He says low income people and new home buyers, he doesn't know how they can afford to live in the Twin Cities anymore, and that he lived here for 17 years and it was heartbreaking to leave. Now, I feel like that sentiment is a rising sentiment, and I think a lot of people feel that way. And we definitely see the difficulty in people wanting to stay and wanting to make a commitment but not being able to afford it. Tori, I wanted to follow up really quickly on something that you said about the cooperative. The cooperative is meant to help them become their own landlords and to help them have more control over this. But how do the cooperative owners deal with the problem of rising rent?
Yeah, the simple answer to that is cooperatives, the incentive is to keep, like when you own it, your incentive is to keep your monthly housing costs low. And so what that spurs all kinds of innovation in how the property is run. But it's essentially operating at cost, right? So rents do increase in co-ops, right? You can ask any one of our co-ops, their rents do increase, but it increases based on need. If the property management firm's fees go up, if the real estate taxes go up. So it's linked to real increases in the operating costs of the property, right? It's not increases to pay, you know, dividends to investor shareholders.
So I think that's great, the idea of them being able to address needs as opposed to addressing like gaining more profit or building more profit. But it's still a very small sort of beginning to address what we now understand is a much bigger issue. I'm going to take a call really quickly. Let's take Sean. Hi,
hello.
Sean. Thanks for calling in. What would you like to share with us today?
Well, I've actually had conversations with Jeff before, and I started a nonprofit called Contain Solution to house homeless and at-risk veterans. It's using existing program, which is the VA home loan mortgage guarantee, which every honorably discharged veteran has, and be able to utilize it to actually get a fourplex so they can get a revenue-generating property and actually solve their life concerns more so than just not having a safe and secure place to live, but actually a place that they can receive revenue from. So not only will they be able to survive, but in this case, actually thrive.
Well, I think that sounds like a fantastic program. Jeff, do you have familiarity with this?
I do. Yeah, I remember the call. I remember the conversation, and just wanted to comment. I think 11 or 12 of the homes that are part of our community land trust are duplexes as well. Speaking to Sean's comment about how do we not only create an opportunity for affordable home ownership, but also start to look at wealth generation opportunities to help folks not only stay in home ownership, but also ideally bring up their incomes a little bit as well.
Well, I think that's a wonderful option. Sean, thank you so much for the call. And Jeff, really quickly, you talked about this program and you talked about some of the work that you're doing. Are there more opportunities? Are there more programs like Sean's out there that can partner with, say, or organizations like yours?
Absolutely. We're in conversations on a weekly basis with not only a number of partner nonprofit organizations that are developing homes, looking at not only creating the affordable home, but ensuring that they stay permanently affordable, but also with a lot of for-profit initiatives. To the credit of, I think, a lot of our local government, the city, the county, and the state, I think increasingly putting policies in place that incent provide additional affordability assistance to create permanently affordable homes. Again, to my earlier comments, it's just getting too costly, unfortunately, to invest the size of investment that's needed today to create a home and not ensure that it stays permanently affordable. And to the point that the caller from Irving made, here's a way to create homes for future generations of buyers in this community that, that, you know, 10, 15 years from now are only going to be even more expensive to capture in the market.
Absolutely. I'm Twyla Dang, and I'm sitting in for Angela Davis. Today, my guests include Jeff Washburn, Executive Director of City of Lakes Community Land Trust, which help low-income homebuyers in Minneapolis purchase homes, and Tori Clark, the Executive Director of North Country Cooperative Foundation based in St. Paul, which helps tenants of mobile home parks and apartment buildings convert them into cooperatives. Now, before we get started, I want to hear from you. Please feel free to call in. We would really love to hear what you have to say about the conversation today. Now, we're going to take a call on line three. You've been so patient. Derek from Victoria.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. What would you like to share today?
Well, you know, this is a question and, an issue that I deal with quite a bit. I'm a city councilman for Victoria, and we have met with the Urban Land Institute. We talk about property owners in our community. And we get told three things: that the land is too expensive, the materials are too expensive, and the labor is too expensive to create housing that's conducive to lower income families, to bring them out here to be a part of our community. And I'm just it gets to be a little overwhelming as somebody who gets asked to maybe solve this problem instead of just maybe making it as better as we can. And just want to find out, you know, the cooperatives and how they work with some of the land trust. You know, the Urban Land Institute talks about the land trust and the limited stock that's out there. But what are some of the things that the cooperatives can do? You know, are they looking to build? Are there developers specifically geared towards cooperatives? It's another tool in the tool belt for a councilman.
That's a great question, Derek. Tori, would you like to jump in there?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say we should talk. you know, we're in conversations with lots of municipalities across the state, as particularly on this topic of the rising construction costs and the cost to develop. And one of the things that we're actively trying to find partnerships for is a new manufactured home development, new manufactured home community development. The cost of manufactured homes are a fraction of what stick-built or even modular housing costs. And so that's one solution that we're trying to deploy. I'm not aware of any developers. I know that there are senior housing co-op developers that are really active in Minnesota. But I'm not aware of any developers that are, you know, focused on building new construction, you know, apartment cooperatives, or that type. But it's an excellent idea.
I think I agree with you. I think it is an excellent idea. We're going to continue the conversation. If you have questions or if you'd like to comment, call us 651-227-6000 or tweet me at Twyla Dang. So, Tori, before the break, we talked a little bit about what you do with the cooperative. So can you tell me about the park in Worthington in southwestern Minnesota?
Yeah, Sungold Heights. It's 106 unit community, home to about 250 households. That community was unique for us in terms of a co-op conversion, in terms of just the racial and linguistic diversity in that particular community. 80% of the community is Latino households, and about 20% are Southeast Asian, many of them first-generation immigrants. So it was a really mission-rich, diverse community organizing experience for us. But that community, we helped the residents of that community convert to co-op ownership in 2019. And the biggest success story for Sungold is that we helped them apply to a new state grant program, the Manufactured Housing Infrastructure Grant Program that's run through Minnesota Housing. And they leveraged a grant from that program to complete a $2.68 million water, sewer, and road rehab project of their community. Which is a huge milestone for manufactured homeowners across the state in terms of leveraging this type of state resource to address some of the deferred maintenance and chronic kind of issues that plague these private infrastructure systems in mobile home parks. This community in particular, just to kind of show you, give you an example, of the conditions in many of these communities. The school buses and the garbage trucks refused to drive through the roads in SunGold prior to this project being done because the potholes and the fissures in the road were so deep. And, you know, residents' cars were having, you know, chronic issues. So huge milestone for SunGold, and I think speaks to the value of co-op local ownership of these types of communities.
Absolutely. So I'm going to take a caller really quickly. Let's talk to Anna from Minneapolis.
Hi.
Anna. Thanks for calling. What would you like to share with us?
I was curious in the discussion about properties that are like a duplex or a fourplex where it's affordable for the person who's buying into the property, and then there's an opportunity to generate additional income with rental units. Is there any protection or expectation of keeping the rental units affordable as well, or is it more just like, well, let's just see how much, I can earn through these?
That's a great question. Jeff?
Absolutely. Great question. One of the things we look at in creating these duplex opportunities for ownership is the requirement to have or essentially mandate a rent restriction. We're a nonprofit organization. Our board at this point in time has not decided to do so. But as we look at the rents that are being charged, about half of the households who own duplexes essentially are renting to family members, and those rents have been affordable. And then the ones who are renting the homes out as a landlord would to a unrelated party, those rents are still significantly lower than what the market rates are when we talk with the homeowners. We do have the opportunity to answer the caller's question. If and when we see that there was a challenge or maybe what's perceived as an abuse, we have the ability upon resale to establish a rent restriction that we could tie to the ground lease, which is the document that binds us with the homeowner in that purchase. So we are watching it. I think it's a valid concern, but it's not been an issue thus far.
Now, Tori, your organization is also expanding this approach to apartment buildings, correct?
That's right. Yep, that's exactly right. Yeah, we're partnering on a project, five buildings in the Corcoran neighborhood of South Minneapolis, Sky Without Limits Co-op. And that's our kind of first foray into assisting apartment building tenants and converting helping those folks secure financing and purchase their property, similar to the same type of model that we do with the mobile home parks.
So I'm going to take another caller. I'm going to go with Patty. She's in Wright County. Hi, Patty. Thanks for calling.
Hello. How are you?
I'm great. What would you like to share with us today?
I'm wondering why the Minnesota Housing and Finance Agency, which I think now is called the Minnesota Housing Authority, is not stepping in to prevent these rent increases at such a drastic rate. It seems to me from my personal experience from them that what they do is they go through a neighborhood and they establish a value of the rent, what everybody's charging, and then either allow or disallow the rents to go up. Well, they're allowing the rents to go up in so many neighborhoods that it's making it not affordable for most people. And that is a problem that should be looked at. The authority that I experienced that I had with them was I went out to the places that they were basing the rents on. I went through the regular kind of thing of asking how much of the rents are, how much are the deposits, and mm-hmm. those kinds of questions, and I got answers. And those answers I compared to what they had told was the reason that our rents were being increased, and they were totally different. They were far above what the rents in the area were, yet the Housing and Finance Corporation let them go ahead and raise the rents. If this happened in one area of our state, by an agency that is at the top of the state as far as regulation goes of rental increases, why aren't they being stopped from making those rent increases? It's obvious that our landowners and entrepreneurs are making a killing now. They ought to be able to at least extend the courtesy to the public who cannot really afford housing, to stick with the ordinance that was once imposed, which is that in any building in Minnesota had to have housing for 10% of its people.
Well, Patty, I think you're making a great point there, and I want to make sure we give a chance to sort of wrap our heads around that a little bit. Jeff, can you talk a little bit about that relationship between the work that your organizations do and, say, working with the government entities?
Yeah, I think the caller makes a great point. And one of the drivers, I think, that a lot of our buyers are motivated to move into homeownership if they can is the cost of rents that are continually increasing and the lock in their mortgage payment that they're allowed to make once they get into a sustainable and supportive home ownership situation. In the case of the state, I think we benefit as community land trust here in the state of Minnesota in that the state housing finance agency has been really supportive in investing in affordability for land trust homes across the state, as well as being a financer for mortgages for low-income buyers purchasing homes. At the same time, so much more is needed if we're going to try to get ahead of this affordable housing problem that we have in the state. And while there are not enough community land trust homes in the state, there is the opportunity to invest today. And it's only going to save us as the taxpayers in the state a lot of money if we can invest in ways that not only create affordability today, but ensure that it stays affordable for future generations of home buyers.
I couldn't agree with you more wholeheartedly. I'm going to take a caller. We're going to talk to Michelle in Minneapolis. Thank you so much, Michelle, for calling.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
What would you like to share with us?
Yeah, so I've been looking for a house and saving up for more than 5 years, and the housing market kind of just kept going up and up and getting less affordable. And I started looking into condos, and that was a little bit more affordable, not my first choice, but I was actually helped a lot by a program called Neighborhood Lift. It's actually a grant, not a loan, forgivable after 5 years, and that is applicable for Minneapolis St. Paul houses or condos, and that was very helpful for that. And then there's a program called PRG.org. They help new first-time home buyers with counseling and affordable housing and workshops. So that was also really helpful.
Well, congratulations to you, Michelle. I'm so glad you were able to purchase your home. Jeff, and I have a question for you. So both land trusts and cooperatives find ways for people to share ownership in a piece of property. Why is owning your home so important? And what impact have you seen on the people who buy their home through the land trust?
Thanks. I had the privilege. I've been with the organization for almost 20 years. And those early years, I was one of very few staff. And so I got to go to a lot of the closings. And as the homeowner that we assisted mentioned earlier in the show, you know, being a first-time buyer, but in many cases, a first-generation home buyer was a powerful thing to be part of, to sit at that closing table and see that someone was able to achieve something they and perhaps their families never thought that they'd be able to achieve. As I've kind of been with the organization a little longer, the thing I really enjoy most is actually touching base with homeowners after they've lived in their home for a year or two and asking that question of what's changed in your life and hearing responses from homeowners that say, you know, I've gone back to school, I've gotten a different job, I've started dating again, are responses that it's amazing to me the kind of not only the stability that's created, but the confidence in households that never thought they could pull this off to be able to do so is huge. And affordable housing is as much about housing as it is about investing in the people. And I think, you know, the cooperative work, the land trust work is really investing in people so that they can do better for themselves and their families. People want that. they just haven't been given the opportunity to help bridge these huge gaps that are only getting bigger as the caller evidenced.
So Tori, how do you feel?
Yeah, I mean, I would echo many of the same sentiments that Jeff just shared, and you know, it many of the same stories with our client co-ops over the years. I've been with NCF for going on 7 years, and worked directly, had a roster of client co-ops that I was providing, you know, direct day-to-day support to, and the stories that we hear after becoming co-op owned and having that security of the land underneath their homes, is really about, you know, folks saying, wow, I know my neighbors now, you know, like I've lived in this park for 20 years and I didn't know who was in the homes, like on either side of me. Right. And they're attending annual meetings. They're getting together. They're thinking creatively to commonly held, challenges, right? They're bringing library services into their communities. You know, they're building community areas so that, you know, they can have after school programming with kids. They're empowered to start actually changing their lived experience and changing their community. And that only comes with ownership, right? Ownership transforms that dynamic. It allows people to see and relate to the world in a new way. And it's amazing. It's absolutely inspiring every day, seeing the type of just organic things that are not spurred on by our organization, right? That just happen and are just given life organically by just owning it, right? And having that control. And all of a sudden the whole world, possibilities open up. But I think, you know, tackling challenges is, you know, I see these creative solutions that our co-ops come up with to commonly held challenges. And I'm like, that's the difference that ownership makes, right? It's giving people the power to change their situation.
I love the opportunity that it seems to be creating for people. But I want to make sure that we've talked so much about sort of the positives and what can be gained. I think it's only fair that we talk a little bit about what some of the challenges to being in a cooperative are. Tori, can you tell me about sort of the challenge of what happens when you go into, say, a mobile home park community and try to organize people to do this?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that we tell folks is that, you know, when you're creating a cooperative, you're going into or a housing co-op, you're going into business with your neighbors. You're creating a legal corporate entity. You're creating a business, and you're going into business with your neighbors, right? And it's a democratic. It's founded on democratic principles: one member, one vote. And as anyone can imagine, democratic ownership, democracy in action, is sometimes complicated, right?
Absolutely.
It requires continual investment. It requires, you know, good listening and empathy, you know, for one another. And that's challenging, right? But that's the joy of our work at NCF, is helping co-ops navigate that, build their capacity, their acumen around tackling some of those community organizing governance challenges.
So Jeff, do you see similar sort of challenges when you're working with the land trust, or what kind of challenges do you see?
You know, the biggest challenge I think that we have and that we have to speak to often is that shared appreciation model. So with our organization, if there's a change in value, the homeowner receives 25% of any increase in value from the time that they've purchased to the time that they sell. 75% of that increase essentially gets passed on to the next low-income buyer. That shared appreciation is a tough thing for a lot of households to stomach. At the same time, but for our investment, households wouldn't be able to have gotten into home ownership. And so it's the trade-off that's made. There is some appreciation, but it doesn't provide for, you know, 100% of any appreciation. If and when there's a downturn in the market, though, I think what the land trust does a beautiful job of is protecting those least able to weather a downturn in the market. So we also share on the downside. The homeowner would lose 25% of any loss, but we're absorbing 75% of that loss, really protecting those least able to withstand something like that.
So I have a question, and it's for both of you. I'm going to start with you, Tori. Can the land trust and cooperatives help build wealth and address the racial wealth gap?
I'd say they're part of the solution, right? I'm careful to never paint cooperative ownership as like this panacea that like solves all ills. It's a tool in the toolbox, So is the land trust model. So is investments in, you know, developing smaller local developers. You know, there's a myriad of solutions here, right? It's not a one size fits all. But I think cooperative ownership has a really important part to play in broadening the continuum of what ownership is, right? The value proposition for co-op ownership in the co-ops, in the types of co-ops that Jeff just spoke to this, the value proposition for households is about stability, right? It's not about, you know, getting rich quick or, you know, building a ton of equity in this asset. That's part of it, right? As it is in the land trust model. But what folks are looking for and what we hear from our constituents and our client co-ops is the thing that changes lives and the thing that helps them build wealth is the stability and the predictability in their housing costs. And that's what these models deliver. When you can stabilize your housing costs, you can invest in other things. Just as, you know, at the top of the hour, the land trust owner that was talking about the stability that her monthly mortgage payment has created. That's what these models deliver. And that's a critical piece of building wealth.
Jeff?
Thank you. I think it's worth noting that Minnesota is the fifth worst as it relates to disparities between whites and households of color in the nation. Over the last 20 plus years, it's always ranked fifth or worse. We talk way too much about the problem in the state and we don't do enough about it. And so I think more does need to be invested. As I mentioned, you know, there's a knock against the land trust because folks aren't able to walk away with 100% of any increase in value, even though there are no guarantees that real estate's always going to generate a return on investment. But as a caller mentioned when she spoke about the LIFT down payment assistance, to be able to get into a purchase offer or a purchase agreement allows a buyer then to access that down payment assistance that's often forgiven. And unless you can get a purchase agreement, which oftentimes necessitates a huge investment from an organization like ours, folks aren't going to be able to take advantage of those forgivable grants as well, or those loans. And so I think all these things are interconnected. It's not the end all be all, but it certainly is part of the solution. And more dollars need to be invested. Kind of back of envelope numbers I was working on a few weeks ago show that if we assisted 5,000 households of color across the state get into home ownership, our ranking would better from fifth worst in the nation to 11th worst in the nation. And that's still horrible, but it's a step in the right direction after so many years of not making any movement.
So, Tori, your group has backed legislation that would make it easier for people living in mobile home parks to buy them. What would the legislation do?
Yeah, we have several priorities this year that we're carrying around providing funding and access to grants. One of the biggest barriers in the mobile home park world for our co-ops is getting over the hump of deferred maintenance of the infrastructure. So we advocate for resources to be made available so that folks can, these resident corporations can cover some of those costs in addition to the mortgage that they get to purchase the property. There's also a resident-led coalition that's going into its second year of concerted effort to pass a bill called Opportunity to Purchase. And that group, this is a law that's gaining traction across the country. Most recently, a law like this was passed in Colorado in 2020. An opportunity to purchase essentially provides a window of opportunity. I think the bill in Minnesota is 60 days. Anytime a park is going to be sold, it provides a window for homeowners to put in a competing offer, right? And provide them that window of opportunity to own and control the land under their homes.
I feel like that's really important. And I'm glad more people are getting to learn a little bit more about it. Jeff, I have one more question for you. Actually, I don't have one more question for you because we need to wrap up for today. Thank you so much, you guys. Our time is up. I want to thank our guest, Tori Clark, the Executive Director of North County Cooperative Foundation in St. Paul, and Jeff Washburn, the Executive Director of City of Lakes Community Land Trust that helps home buyers in Minnesota. Also, thank you to Tisha Selman, who brought her house in Minneapolis at the Shikokik neighborhood that spoke to us earlier in the show today. So, this conversation was produced by Maya Beckstrom, and I'm Twyla Dang, sitting in for Angela Davis. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.
Thanks for listening to a recording of my live radio show on NPR News. A reminder, if you want to catch the show in real time, tune in and call in at a new time, 9 a.m. weekdays on NPR News.